are out there busy shoveling, and we're going to talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about the liability issues associated with snow and things like that in a little bit.
Really bringing the holiday cheer to everyone.
Oh, I got some topics that people will definitely make fun of me. That people often say I sometimes bring down the holiday with some of the legal topics. So we'll try and keep it fun. So we're here at the Talk 1300. We are a call-in radio show, so we love getting your calls here at the studio at 476-1300. It's pretty simple. We call in the number, and we have two engineers today, Brendan and Josh. One of them will pick up the phone. Just ask your name and where you're from, and we'll get you on the air as soon as we can. Now, I'm talking with Brandon before the show began. He said that we're not going to get that many callers today. That the Napa Auto Show, they had a half their normal callers. So he said the law show is probably not going to get too many callers. So that's a challenge, folks.
I think it is.
Brandon's laying down the gauntlet saying Talk 1300 listeners of the Gervin Filazza Law Show are not going to call in this morning. So let's see what you can do. Give us a buzz, and we'll answer any legal questions you may have, or certainly try and point you in the right direction, or just talk about some legal topics of the day. And James and I are fully prepared in the event that we don't get any callers. But give us a buzz here at the studio at 476-1300. I was on the radio show 2 weeks ago, I think. So, you know, if some of the folks who are regular listeners may recall that I'm one of the firm's partners. I'm primarily a labor and employment law attorney, but, of course, having done this show for about 11, 12 years now, I've had to answer questions on a whole host of topics. So it's one of the nice things about the show is you get pretty well versed in a lot of different areas of the law. So, you know, you can call us with any questions, but certainly any labor and employment law type of questions. You got any issues about your job or your paycheck or things like that, give us a call, and I can certainly speak to.
I can vouch for that. Scott can certainly help you on that because I ask him questions about it all the time.
And James, why don't you give the folks a little sense of what you do in the office?
Well, I do some labor and employment law, not in the same realm as Scott. I'm more involved in the labor side in terms of our work that we do with various municipalities, some districts, school districts, and other police departments, things like that. So, you know, the negotiations, the personnel issues, those kind of issues I deal with. And then, that's a lot of my days recently has been involved with something along those lines.
Yeah, when it comes to labor and employment law, there are kind of two different worlds. We do have our public sector labor law, which is has its own complexities as a result of the fact that a lot of municipal employees are members of unions. They're civil servants. So it has its own unique issues. And of course, I work with a lot of private sector, mm-hmm. Employers, and they have their own unique sets of issues. So if you have those kind of issues, give us a call. We'd love to talk to you or anything. Last time I was on 2 weeks ago, I was here with one of our, associates, Aaron Morris, and, we got a couple labor and law questions. We got some good property questions, and Erin was perfect for that because she is one of our resident property attorneys. So, you know, we can handle most anything. And one of the things that I wanted to start off with is obviously we got a lot of snow out there.
Yeah.
Coming here, I was telling James that I had the good fortune of following 3 snowplows the entire way here, which was a godsend. I think as I'm watching the folks outside the TU arena here, plowing out the walkways and laying down the salt, you know, it always, as I'm mm-hmm. walking here, slipping and gripping, trying to not bite the dust, it always gets me thinking about the obligation of property owners. And I think having done the show for a number of years now, I found that we get a lot of property questions because the ownership of property is something that is something a lot of us share. Mm-hmm. I am a homeowner. James, you're a renter.
I am not. I avoid most of that. I rent an apartment, so thank goodness for that.
So James has a landlord that's assuming all liability. And of course that, you know, being a landlord does have some unique
sure.
responsibilities, for, you know, really ensuring not only myself as a homeowner, my obligation is to ensure that my property is safe, that it, for anyone who may reasonably come onto it. And, these days with about a FedEx guy in my driveway about twice a day, this is definitely the time where I expect people to be coming to my home.
It's kind of the ultimate irony is the time when your property might be at the, at its worst condition is when you're probably more likely to expect actual guests and other people walking across it.
Yeah, and but as a landlord, you know, you have to ensure not only the public safety, but also all of your tenants.
Yep.
And, you know, landlords find themselves in a host of issues in the winter seasons, or facing a host of issues in the winter season, anything from the obvious of snow removal. But things like icicles. I remember I lived in an apartment in Schenectady when I was in law school, and it would grow these daggers that would hang off of the roof. And it was an older home. It wasn't an apartment complex or a building. And so when a little bit of warmth would hit, those would start falling, and they were dangerous. You know, and we've seen cases of people who have been injured by falling icicles, and if you are a landlord, you have some exposure for some liability. So we're going to talk about those issues a little more, but yeah. I think we do have a caller from Albany. Do we have Ronnie, excuse me. Ronnie, how you doing?
Good. I got a two-part question.
Okay.
I plow for a couple landlords. I'm a landlord myself, but I plow for them and I shovel. Am I liable at all if one of their tenants falls and says, hey, he didn't shovel, you know, would that come back on me?
Well, you know, first things first is, do you have any type of written agreement with the person that
no.
you... Okay, it's all.
No, that's my other question. I've been doing it for years, and I've never had. It's just been a verbal thing. Mm-hmm. I plow and I shovel, and I've never had a problem. But if one of their tenants were to fall, and I'm the one shoveling and sanding, which I do and keep up on it, but like you were just saying, I've done it this morning already, and I'm sure it's already covered. I can't stand there all day just putting salt down on the walkway or the driveway. So, my question is, should I come up with a contract next year stating I am not liable for anything that happens? And on my own property, I take care of, I have insurance for that, so I should be okay.
Well, and that's why I asked you about the agreement. You know, an agreement for, you know, the service of snow plowing, it could have two types of provisions in it. You know, one provision to your benefit could say that you are absolved from any liability associated with injuries, connected with whatever it is you plow or shovel, that sort of thing. That would be good for you. The converse of that would be that the landowner puts in some sort of caveat in an agreement that says that you may be held responsible for this, any injuries in the event that you don't do it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, you are not going to, if a person who rents, let's take James here.
Sure.
He's our resident renter.
That's right.
Let's say James, you know, comes out of his apartment and Ronnie has shoveled it, but obviously the snow is still falling here in Albany.
Right.
And so James falls down.
Right.
In most scenarios like that, James is going to sue the landlord. They're
okay.
not going to sue you. James would have to show that you engaged in, you had a duty to him to keep that property safe, which you generally don't as a private contractor that's being hired to perform a service,
okay.
and that you breached that duty in
right.
some way. So even if you had that responsibility, he'd also have to show that you were negligent in some manner. Now,
okay.
with that said, if this landowner has contracted with you to clear walkways or driveways and you don't do it, or you do it in a haphazard, or you know, you fail to do it in the manner one would expect you to do it,
right.
If the landlord got sued by James, could the landlord potentially try and bring you into that lawsuit saying, I hired Ronnie to plow my driveways and shovel my walkway, and he didn't do it, or he did it and it was a really terrible job. So as a result, James fell. So it's not all my responsibility. It's part of Ronnie's.
Right.
You know, is that possible? Sure.
Sure.
I mean, you know, people always say to me, Scott, how do I avoid a lawsuit? And the answer is you
right.
can't. There is no way to avoid one. The only thing to avoid or try and avoid is a successful one. Yes. So,
right.
you know, what would I advise someone, Ronnie, in your position to do? I think a written contract outlining who is responsible and who is not for any injuries associated with the things you plow or shovel, sure, not a bad idea. You know, making sure that if you're doing it, the work, doing it in a good quality manner, or if you hire people to do it, that you're making sure your folks are out there doing it right. You know, that's, I think, about the best you're going to be able to do. And then, of course, have some type of insurance for your business. You know, if,
well, it's just me doing it. I only do two houses, and it's not a business. I just know the landlord, and I'm a landlord, and he doesn't have a plow, and I do, and I've been doing it for 10 years. I've never had a problem.
Yeah.
But just listening to you talk, if one of his tenants did fall, I mean, I do a really good job, but still, I did it this morning, and it's covered with snow now, I'm sure. So,
yeah, I mean, most of the time when a tenant falls or is injured on property, they're looking to the homeowner because the homeowner has insurance. That's, you know, you as an attorney, one of the things when someone comes through my door and says, I want to sue my landlord, just for this hypothetical, we look at a couple things. We look at, well, is there liability? Did the landlord fail to do something they had a responsibility to do? And if the landlord, let's just say they didn't plow or shovel anything, they just let four or five inches of snow sit there, well, we may have liability. And then, we always look at damages. Does the person have something that's worth a suit over? If the person says, well, I fell down and I had a small bruise on my knee, I might say, well, what's that worth?
Right.
Where, compare that to somebody who breaks a leg or has some kind of spinal injury where there's some real damages. And the last thing, of course, is, are you going to be able to recover? You know, it's one thing to sue. It's another thing to win. It's a whole other thing to collect on it. You know, so the person is probably not looking at Ronnie, which would be a very complicated legal claim, and you're just an individual, as compared to a homeowner that has insurance through a large, very profitable, most likely insurance company. So, you know, I think you're running your liabilities pretty low, but, you know, would it hurt to have some sort of written agreement with the landlord stating that you have no responsibility after you pick up your shovel and get in your truck and leave? Not a bad idea.
Yeah. Would I need a lawyer to do that, or is that something I could just do my type up myself and just have us both sign it? Or should I do it, spend a couple $100 on a lawyer?
Well, you know, legal contracts, there is no there's no formality requirement. You could have a written contract with someone. Some of the more famous ones are on napkins and, you know, little scraps of paper. You know, and I think, you know, the question, is it better to have an attorney prepare a contract that you're developing to avoid liability? You know, absolutely. You know, an attorney is going to be able to help you craft the best contract to serve your purposes. Can you do it on your own? I think most people could get a basic contract together. But to get what you're talking about really is indemnification. And that is when one party to an agreement says, I will cover you in the event that something bad happens as a result of this contract. And that's something that an attorney really is best to prepare. So, yeah, I mean, a couple $100, you know, to get a basic contract put together might save you thousands of dollars down the road.
Right. Is it even worth it for me to do it for, like you said, you just said, I don't have insurance to go plow somebody's property. And I know there's a lot of plow guys out there doing it, but I own a lot of real estate and I have a big portfolio, and I just would hate to have somebody sue me.
Yeah, Ronnie, I've not heard of a lot of people, and we invite people to call in if you've experienced this, but people suing plow companies for, you know, injuries associated with people falling and slipping on the ice. More plow companies, people do plowing, they get sued for damage to property. Scraping up your lawn, damaging your driveway, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, I'm sure it has happened, but it's not something I see happen. I've ever heard of, really.
Right.
And it doesn't sound like this is your business. Now, I mean,
I only do it for two houses, you know. I don't do it for anybody. Just, I've been doing it, like I said, for 10 years now, 12 years, because he doesn't have a plow, and he owns property next to me, and I just said, hey, I'll do it. You pay me this much, and blah, 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 and he's always paid. I always do a good job, but just listening to you, you know, you got to be aware of something can happen.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, our job as lawyers is we're always looking out for your clients' dangers, you know, and that's one of the burdens, you know, we live with as attorneys, because every step I take, I'm always seeing liability issues wherever they are. You know, just walking down here, there was one stretch of sidewalk which was very, very slippery. It hadn't been shoveled. It hadn't been salted. This is in downtown here, and I thought, boy, you know, that's dangerous. I've slipped a few times on that. You know, so we're always looking to minimize liability, but there does come a tipping point with life that you can't insulate yourself from all liability. Right. So, you know, I can't tell you don't have a contract or you must have a contract, but in any, you know, you're in a business situation with this person, never a bad idea to have a contract, but you're not out there with your occupation, you're making your living plowing driveways. So, you know, the guys I saw out there this morning with their name on the side of their truck is Joe's Plumbing or Joe's Plowing, you know, those guys definitely they should have liability insurance. They should have, you know, agreements putting those kind of things out. So,
right.
All right, Ronnie. Well, thanks. I hope that helps.
Yeah.
And good luck out there. Same to everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
The one thing I could think of too, Scott, when just what it, his one concern about the snow falling after he does it, mm-hmm. it just kind of reminded me of, I think in a lot of states there is a storm in progress doctrine that basically says, you know, this is more for homeowners in general, that, you know, if it's snowing outdoors and it's been snowing for 2-3 hours, I don't have to constantly be going out there shoveling my sidewalk just to have it shoveling the pathway to my house just to have it refill up. You get a reasonable amount of time after the storm stops to go do it. I'm not sure if I would apply to someone like Ronnie where it's his professional job, but, you know, that's also, there are, the way the law tries to be interpreted is a way to try and understand that sometimes, practically speaking, you can't be expected to do these things.
Yeah, most of those ordinances are local municipal ordinances. I know here in Albany, I moved out of Albany just last year, and I know in Albany the rule was you had 24 hours from the last snowflake hitting the ground. That was generally the rule, that you had one day from after the snow stopped to get out there and clear sidewalks and any areas of public egress and ingress. But, I think there's two issues there, James, you're presenting. And then we're going to get to Fran. We're going to get to her with a couple minutes before the break, but I just want to finish this. There's two issues there. One is legal compliance. The law says thou shalt, shovel their walkway within 24 hours of thine last snowflake hitting the ground. That is one side of this. What we were talking about with Ronnie is kind of the other side of this, which is civil liability.
Right.
Can I get sued? So you may be able to wait 24 hours to be in compliance with a local municipal ordinance, but in that 24 hours, someone could slip and fall and you could be found negligent and therefore civilly liable. So, fun topic for today is the snow falls. We're going to get Fran on the line and we got, I think, about 3 minutes before the break. So we're going to get Fran on, see if we can get her issue, and then we'll take our break. Fran, are you still there?
I'm still here. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I think you kind of just answered my question. I have two questions, though. I was wondering about having someone plow with my snow blower because it's not practical for me to use it. So, but I do have an umbrella policy, so I'm just wondering if that is sufficient or not. That's my first question. My second question is, it's totally different. It's related to selling a car.
Okay.
But I'm not selling it, though. I'm going to gift it to a relative. How do I write up the sale paper for motor vehicles since there's no money taking place?
Yeah. Well, Fran, you know, we're gonna deal with your easier question first, because I'm much more familiar with snow removal than car contracts. But don't worry, we're gonna get an answer to the second one probably more after the break. You know, Fran, you said you have a general umbrella policy for your property. Good.
Yeah.
Always good to have. You know, insurance policies are tricky though. It's very, you know, a lawyer can never, you know, say as a general premise what an insurance policy covers and what it doesn't. There are a host of exclusions to every insurance policy, and most of the time people find out about those exclusions when you go to make a claim and your insurer says, well, that's not covered. And I'll admit, you know, insurance policies are typically dense legal documents. They're in single spaced 10 point print. You know, the tiniest micro printing. You got to get a magnifying glass out to read these things. And even I will be guilty of just saying, agree. You know, like when you get that screen up on your computer, you just say, I can't read all that. You know, so one of the things you'll want to do is pull out that insurance policy and call your insurer and say, in this situation, would I be covered? And they can usually give you a close approximation of whether it would be. Again, there's always things that can happen that might, you know, allow an insurer to disclaim coverage. And your example is one that may be that kind of situation. You know, your policy may cover you using a snowblower on your property. It may not cover someone else using a snowblower on your property. It probably does. You know, that's the whole idea of an umbrella policy. It, keeps all of the legal rain off your head. But you know, you never know in those situations. So, you know, and that is going, you know, your insurance policy is a contract between you and the insurance company. So it's all going to be dictated by the terms of the contract.
Okay, I guess I'll have to dig it out and take a look and give them a call.
Yeah,
some fun reading. Sure.
Well, we're gonna answer your other question too, Ronnie, about the car. But I think we do have a break coming up in a little bit.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just hang on the hang on the line after the break. We'll get to you.
Well,
you know,
I think I'll just listen for the answer.
That works.
On that.
All right. Well, thanks, Fran, for the call.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Stay warm.
So, you know, but I think, you know, one of the things I don't want to do in this show ever is, you know, frighten people. You know, we want to talk about these issues. So we're going to talk a little bit more about Fran's issue. We're going to talk about her car issue as well. When we come back, we'll hopefully get Fran an answer to that.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Gervin and Ferlazzo Law Show here on Talk 1300. We're going to be back in a few minutes to talk a little more.
WGDJ, Wrestler, Paul Vandenberg, Fred Vicker, and Michael Savage Afternoons, the Capital District's talk station, Talk 1300.
Turning deadly in Baltimore this morning. At least two people were killed and a dozen others hurt after a fiery tanker truck crash.
Investigators say the crash happened when a gas tanker truck flipped over and went off an elevated portion of I-95 in downtown Baltimore. The icy roads then caused about 40 cars and trucks to get tangled in several wrecks along the stretch of roadway. The freezing rain began in the overnight hours with temperatures in the mid-20s, making for some slick road conditions. Phil Yakubuski, ABC News, Baltimore.
The winter wallop comes as many Americans are making their holiday getaway. Air travel also affected. FlightAware showing more than 1,600 flights have already been canceled. The FBI says it's backing the CIA conclusion Russian hackers interfered with the U.S. presidential election. President Obama agrees, telling reporters Friday the evidence points all the way to the top. President-elect Donald Trump has questioned the CIA's findings. I'm Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
A payday for Hoosick Falls. I'm Mike Carey in the Talk 1300 studio at the Times Union Center. The village of Hoosick Falls will receive $850,000 in a settlement regarding contamination of the village's drinking water. Mayor David Borge announced yesterday the agreement calls for the St. Gobain and Honeywell companies to pay the village for dumping PFOAs into the water system. The agreement was first disclosed earlier this week, but residents complained the financial terms were not disclosed. As a result, the village board tabled a motion to accept the deal and agreed to hold another meeting December 28th so the public could become informed. Board says the money will be used to cover costs incurred by the village to clean up the contamination. A Glenville man received his sentence yesterday in a 2011 sexual assault. 49-year-old Lawrence Atkins will serve 6 years in prison. Prosecutors say he sexually assaulted a woman he picked up as she walked along Route 50 after leaving a concert at SPAC. They say he drove the woman to the parking lot of the Price Chopper in Glenville, where he proceeded to rape her. They add they tied Atkins to the crime through his DNA that was in the state data bank due to a previous crime. He pled guilty to criminal sex act in exchange for the 6-year sentence. Taxes will be increasing in the city of Watervliet. City Council has approved a $12 million budget that carries a tax hike of 1.9%. Plan increases spending 2.5%. The budget increases taxes by just over $11 per thousand of assessed value, meaning the average home assessed at $127,000 will see an increase of about $41. Two men are being credited with saving a Hadley man after his car burst into flames. Saratoga County Sheriff's deputies say David DeMarco was driving on North Shore Road in Hadley when he lost control. The car rolled over and caught fire. Deputies say George Borden of South Glens Falls and Thomas Fifield of Mayfield were driving in the area and saw the accident. They say the men stopped and pulled DeMarco from the burning vehicle. Deputies say DeMarco suffered minor injuries, but it could have been worse if not for the actions of Borden and Fifield. Hudson police say a frozen woman found yesterday is just a mannequin. They say they were called to a vehicle parked on City Hall Place yesterday morning after someone found what appeared to be an elderly woman that froze to death in a car. Police say they broke the rear passenger window and opened the door, only to discover it was a very lifelike mannequin wearing a CPR training device. Mannequin was fully clothed, detailed, and strapped into a seatbelt. No charges are pending. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan and Police Chief Brendan Cox will hold a press conference Monday morning. Although the topic hasn't been released, it comes as multiple reports and multiple sources say Cox is resigning. He spent 22 years with the Albany Police, became chief in April of 2015 following the departure of Steve Krokoff.
Here's your Talk 1300 forecast. This afternoon, a light, spotty, wintry mix in the area with temperatures in the 20s and 30s. For tonight, clouds, some drizzle and fog with scattered light rain showers and temperatures climbing into the 30s. By Sunday, early day rain tapers as temperatures stay in the 40s for a little while. We chill it down later in the day with blustery wind, then dropping into the teens. A few clouds Sunday night, mostly sunny by Monday with highs only in the 20s. That's the latest forecast from Time Warner Cable News. I'm meteorologist Heather Morrison for Talk 1300.
I'm Mike Carey. You're up to date on your home for Siena basketball. Talk 1300.
Now, the most live local talk with the Gervin and Ferlazzo Law Show.
Welcome back to the Gervin and Ferlazzo Law Show. Again, my name is Scott Cannell. I'm here with James Gervin. We're your hosts today. Give us a call here at the studio, 476-1300. We've had a few callers this morning. We had Ronnie and Fran with some, some snow-related questions, you know, popular topic today. As James and I across the street from the TU Arena are watching people fall on the unshoveled walkways as we're laughing here in the studio, just how topical this is today.
Not laughing at the people falling.
No, no.
We need to make that clear, because I very well might be that person in about 45 minutes walking to my car.
You got some winter shoes there, Jim.
I know.
You got sneakers on.
I don't plan well, Scott, and today would be a good example of that.
No, we're laughing only because it's just so funny. We're talking about the liability issues associated with this, and we're literally watching the scenario we're describing unfold across the street from the TU Arena. So Fran had an interesting question, and during the break, I did do a little internet digging, which I always do when I'm not certain on something. And Fran did pose a question about, you know, donating a vehicle. And sadly, Fran's not on the line because we had some more questions for her in terms of what exactly she was curious to find out about. Now, there's a couple layers to this. One would be, presuming Fran was talking about the nuts and bolts of transferring a car to one person from one person to another with no cost. Mm-hmm. It's really an issue between Fran and the DMV. How she goes about doing that. Making sure it's just documented properly. Who is the owner of this vehicle? Then we have a whole nother issue though that comes up with the donation of vehicles, and a lot of people choose to donate a vehicle to a charity, and that can result in a tax deduction. And if Fran were looking for some type of tax benefit out of donating the car, I think sadly Fran's going to be out of luck, because normally those rules only apply to charitable deductions. And really, it's think of the car really as a pile of cash equal to the value of the car. And really, what you're doing, make a wish. I know mm-hmm. that's a charity. I was the first one that popped up here when I was Googling car donation. You know, it would be really, if you gave them a $5,000 vehicle, it would be really no different than giving them $5,000 in cash. And so the IRS recognizes that a charitable deduction can be in many forms, including a vehicle. So for donation of a vehicle to a charity, there are some tax benefits associated with that. And there's a process for documenting the fact that you're donating it to a charity to ensure that the IRS is going to be okay with you putting that on your tax form at the end of the year. So, you know, Fran, I hope we helped you with your question a little bit. Any question like that, I would always tell someone if they called my office, call the DMV. Yeah. That's your first place. You know, those are the car folks here in New York. So anyway, hope we helped, Fran, and thank you very much. Again, we're here at 476-1300, and I think we do have another caller. James, who we got?
It looks like we've got Donna in Delmar. Good morning,
Hi.
Donna.
Hi. I went in for to correct my eyesight for LASIK.
Okay.
And was told that I wasn't a candidate for LASIK and I had to have cataract surgery.
Okay.
And after having the cataract surgery that wasn't successful, they did another surgery that now my eyesight is worse. It's worse than it was in the beginning, totally.
Okay. Sorry to hear that. So you – and what is your question? It would be, you know, what's your –
do I have a case against the practice?
Yep.
Because – there were a multitude of different doctors talking to me. It was never just one doctor.
Mm-hmm. Well, anytime you have some sort of medical procedure, and certainly corrective eye surgery, cataract surgery, any of those things, those are medical procedures. Doctors have a responsibility to give you advice and perform any procedures in an appropriate professional manner, meaning up to the standards of any reasonable doctor.
Right.
And so the first question would be, did someone, you know, so we would look at this in terms of, is this a medical malpractice situation? Did the doctor or did multiple doctors breach their duty of professionalism that they owed to you as their patient? You know, and when we look at one of those, situations, we look to see what were you told and was that advice correct? Or let's say the advice was correct, was the procedure that was performed to the standards of a typical doctor? And whenever one of those lawsuits comes through our door, and we, in our firm, we do handle a good number of medical malpractice cases, one of the things we do is, and actually by law here in New York, you have to do is you have to have a doctor evaluate the case. So we have to have an independent physician review your medical records, your treatment history, all of it, basically the whole world of documents relating to your eyeballs and what happened to them recently, and then tell us, does the doctor think that your doctor or multiple doctors gave you bad advice, meaning maybe you didn't have cataracts or you had a different problem, or if the diagnosis was correct, did they do the procedures properly? Sometimes a doctor comes back and says, this was not bad advice. It was, you know, probably the best advice that could be given under the circumstances. Or a doctor might come back and say, that's totally wrong. You know, that doctor dropped the ball in giving Fran that advice. The doctor missed something or they wrongly diagnosed the problem. Let's say, though, the advice were correct to you that, you know, you needed some procedure, then our doctor would look at, was the procedure performed appropriately? Which is a little trickier. That's harder to piece together. And that's what they would really look at in your situation. So it's very case specific. You know, we would have to, you know, take a look at all of your medical history and try and see where something was done incorrectly.
Well, the one thing that I take issue with is that it wasn't one doctor advising me. It was so many doctors that it was very confusing.
Okay.
And they were, it felt like, and maybe it's not true, but it felt like they were pushing a lens that was on sale.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I mean, we have seen malpractice situations where, you know, doctors oftentimes, there is an incentive to, you know, utilize a certain medication or administer a certain medication or use a certain type of device during a surgical procedure. And there are restrictions on that sort of thing with doctors, you know, because the purpose of a doctor is to give you the best advice, not the best advice that also behooves the doctor at the end of the day in some sort of financial level. So, you know, if the doctor really did have you go through some sort of treatment or procedure because it was to his or her financial best interest and it wasn't in Donna's best medical interest, then absolutely that could be a malpractice situation. You know, and with multiple doctors, it gets tricky. You know, I have had family members go through some very serious medical issues where there are a team of physicians involved. And you know, that becomes very tricky, you know, and when they, particularly if they conflict. You know, now it sounds like most of your folks that you were dealing with tended to be on the same page. So then the question would be, did one or did collectively they commit some kind of malpractice? So I think, Donna, you know, what you'd want to do is, give us a call during the week. You can call us at 462-0300. That's our office number. And we'll be happy to talk with you in a little more detail about your situation. Obviously, talking more specifics that we wouldn't want you to talk about your medical situation on the radio. and just walk through it with you and figure out, is there something that a doctor did wrong here? And if so, can we trace any injury you have now or problems you may have in the future to that failure by that doctor? If there is, you may have a legal claim. So give us a call during the week. We'll be happy to chat with you about that and hope we're able to help you a little bit.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you. And for anyone else, you know, obviously it's some folks, and I fully understand it, may be a little reluctant to talk about their medical situations on the radio. You can always call us at the office. We're happy to talk with you at 462-0300. Anytime during the week. So just call and ask for James, ask for me, or if you have those type of medical malpractice questions, you can always ask for Sal Ferlazzo or Daniel Rubin, who are our resident medical malpractice attorneys. So we did get a little clarification. Then we're going to get to Richard from Rensselaer, who's on the phone. And good for our callers today.
I know.
We are really showing up. Brendan here, who said we're not going to get any calls, so good for you folks. Fran's question, though, she did call back. Her question had to do with sales tax. And it looks like Fran's looking, probably trying to avoid sales tax.
I would imagine.
You know, on the sale of the vehicle. And there are, I can tell you, there are a host of very specific rules when it comes to transferring vehicles. I remember what used to happen was when you would sell a car, let's say you sold it for $5,000, someone would write you a check for $2,500 and you'd get $2,500 cash, and or at least I've heard of this situation. and then you'd write up the receipt for a $2,500 purchase because that's what was, quote, on the record through the check. And I think that that's been clamped down on a bit, you know, those sorts of efforts to avoid sales tax. And so what you want to do, Fran, is you want to contact the DMV. Ask them the question, you know, what I want to give this car away, and I presume Fran wants to avoid any sales tax. The question is, how do I do that? You know, so I would contact the DMV and see if they can answer that question. I'm sure they can help you, Fran. So hope that helps you, Fran. But, of course, Fran and anyone else, if you have those kind of questions, call us during the week at 462-0300. But right now we're here at Talk 1300, 476-1300, 476-1300. And we have Richard from Rensselaer. Richard, how are you?
Okay.
Well, just okay. We're going to try and see if we can get you good to go. So what can we do for you?
Well, I'm wondering, since you represent so many municipalities, would you be able to represent somebody or give advice on somebody that would be an employee who'd be considering suing a government agency?
Well, you know, your question is, can our law firm represent someone suing a municipality? Sure. Depends on the municipality, though. We certainly can't sue our own clients. We're prohibited by the ethics rules from doing that, and that would just be bad business as well. But, you know, is it possible for a law firm that represents municipal clients to sue a municipality? Sure. Unless there were that kind of conflict. But let's do this, Richard. Why don't we talk about your issue just kind of generally? Let's not mention who the municipality is or anything that could identify it. And, why don't you just tell us about your situation a little bit?
Well, I want to know if, the employee could sue in New York State on, pain and suffering sorts of things, the employer.
Well, it's going to depend on the source of the pain and suffering. So are we talking about an injury, or are we talking about a harassment sort of issue?
Yeah, more like harassment abuse sorts of things.
Yeah.
Not promoting, not giving appropriate work, that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, not promoting and not giving certain types of work. You know, let's take a step back for a moment. And, again, municipal employees are different. Because they have protections under the civil service law. Most, as I mentioned, municipal employees are also union employees. Not all, but quite a number of them are. And so any union employee is going to have the rights under a collective bargaining agreement. And if a municipal employer violated the term of a collective bargaining agreement as it relates to things like assignment or promotion, then the employee could pursue a grievance.
That would be the first step.
And James can speak chapter and verse on employee grievances. I'm sure he's dealt with quite a few on the public side of
things. Quite a few. And that would probably always be your first question. If you were to sue or bring a claim in court, one of the first issues would be, did you pursue all administrative avenues and remedies first? Yeah. So, but assuming you've gone past that, let's say.
And then there are, I know for New York State employees, I've presented to some, groups of New York State employees, and I'm always thrown a little bit because they have special rules for certain things. So as an employee of New York State, as opposed to a more local municipality, you may have special rights as it relates to things like promotion and assignment. But putting all of that aside, unless you're violating a contract or some sort of legal right you have under something like the civil service law, most of the time you really have limited recourse when it comes to things like promotions and assignments, unless the reason for the lack of a promotion or the bad assignment is some type of unlawful discrimination, harassment, or retaliation. And what I mean by that is, if you, Richard, said, well, I'm not being promoted or I'm getting bad assignments because I'm a man or because of the color of my skin or because of my religion or my sexual orientation or those sorts of things, that would be unlawful. And you would have some ability to collect for the emotional distress, the mental pain and suffering you've experienced as a result of those actions by your employer.
But if they don't say in writing that, well, we're discriminating against you because of your sex.
Rarely do they.
if they said that, that would be amazing.
Yeah, that's what we
you have. Then what all can you do to say that it is one of those reasons?
Well, I'll tell you, Richard, you know, I've been defending employers in harassment and discrimination lawsuits for over a decade now, and rare is the day anyone puts it in writing, I am hereby not transferring you because you are, you know, a male. You know, most people, I think, in the modern era, you know, in 2016, know not to do something that stupid. So, you know, every discrimination case is far more subtle these days. And in your case, you know, if we thought, hypothetically speaking, Richard is not getting assignments because he's a man, only women seem to be getting promotions in Richard's department, we would look at history. We would look at it and we would say, okay, Richard has been passed over 6 times for a female employee. What is the reason the employer is giving for that? Now, the employer may have a completely legitimate reason. You know, maybe you had a performance deficiency. Maybe you had some misconduct in your past and that's why they're saying you're not getting promoted. If they have no answer to that, that's going to be a tough day for them. But more often than not, employers have lawyers like me, who put forth those reasons. You know, the reason we're not promoting Richard or John or Jane or Sally or Johnny is because of this problem associated with them. And that's, at that point, that is the most difficult part of any discrimination lawsuit, because what the employee has to show is that the employer's stated reason, their legitimate non-discriminatory reason for failing to hire, for firing, for failing to promote, for giving bad assignments to the person is false. It is a pretext. It's a lie. And the real reason is discrimination. And that's the hardest part to prove when you're a plaintiff bringing one of those lawsuits. It's the place where most discrimination lawsuits fail and the cases get dismissed, because the person doesn't have that good proof. They don't have the supervisor making a comment or writing an email saying something to the effect that Richard is not getting hired because men are not going to be promoted in this department, kind of thing. You know, that's why, you know, that's the job, though, of an attorney. You know, our job is to ferret out that evidence and try and determine if there's something out there which is clear and shows that discrimination was a factor or something more subtle.
And then there's also statute of limitations, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You've got like 6 months and you have to have a certain event that you're saying is this, even though it's a pattern over many years, you know, like promotions, it's not like they're happening every day. So, you know, you have to go back after, over, you know, this history of could be years that it's been, you know, when you said six, it may take a couple of years for that to have occurred 6 times.
Yeah, statute of limitations are always important. You know, almost every legal claim that's out there is subject to some sort of time restraint.
Mm-hmm.
The people who have enacted those laws have said that there has to be a certain point where we say, this controversy is too old. We, you know, you didn't bring this forth in a timely fashion. And for public employees or for claims against municipal entities, there is a something called a notice of claim requirement, where you have to, within 90 days, present your claim to the municipality. And if you don't, could be barred. Now, that doesn't apply to all claims, but that's how short a limitations period can be, 3 months. So, you know, but a typical discrimination claim is governed by statute of limitations that run anywhere from about 300 days to as much as 3 years. And what we look at for statute of limitations purposes for any discrimination case is the last discriminatory event. That is what is going to be the trigger for when the statute of limitations begins to run, when that stopwatch of time begins to start ticking. That can be tricky in a harassment situation because sometimes, as Richard is alluding to, this stuff can be subtle.
Right.
It can happen over an extended period of time, and that's why the law recognizes something called the continuing violation doctrine. So I'll use James as my guinea pig here.
All right.
If I came into the office every single day and I told James how good he looks in his shirt and tie and how well he fills it out, and
thanks,
I'm sexually harassing him every day, you know, James might put up with that for a little while. He might say, well, you know, Scott's a partner and, you know,
the boss.
I don't want to, you know, put any ripples in the water. I'm just going to put up with it for a while. A lot of people do that in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
But then it goes on and it continues. And in most situations like that, when the employee doesn't speak up, it gets worse. You know, maybe I start grabbing James. Maybe I start, you know, rubbing his shoulders and his back and things, you know, and we can all imagine the type of sexual harassment situation we might have going on. At a certain point, James might say, stop, that's enough, I'm done with this, and he goes and he files a lawsuit against me for discrimination. What the law may recognize under the continuing violation doctrine is if there was a pattern, a consistent course of behavior on my part, the law says, well, you can go back to some of those things that occurred before the statute of limitations because they're part of this long string of events. You know, now if they're spaced far apart, or they're maybe one day I'm sexually harassing him, the other day, next day I'm harassing him because of his religion, you can break that chain, and then some of those events you may not be able to include in your harassment lawsuit. But most of the time, you know, those things, type of things are part of a pattern of behavior. With a failure to promote claim, if you're not being harassed on a daily basis, meaning you're just getting passed over for promotion, let's say once a year, there you got to be much more careful because the continuing violation doctrine may not apply. Those once a year events are not part of a continuous pattern of ongoing behavior enough to allow for us to look at all of them. So, you know, you got to be careful. But I think with any legal claim, Richard, and thank you for the call. Richard, we only got 2 minutes left, so we're going to kind of wrap up Richard's call. But, you know, if you have any legal claim, you're thinking to yourself, like we had Fran, Donna, who had the problem with her eyes, mm-hmm. You know, questioning, did she get proper medical care and treatment? That is something you do not want to wait on. That is something you do not want to ruminate and think, well, gee, I'm not sure. You want to go now.
Yep.
Medical malpractice claims, most all type of malpractice claims are subject to relatively short statutes of limitations. I believe MedMal is 2.5 years, or
it might
two,
be could be even less. Yeah. I don't recall. That's back law school at this point for me. But yes, it's a short amount of time that will go by a lot faster than you might think.
You know, a breach of contract claim is 6 years, so you know you can wait on a breach of contract, like we had our first caller today with his snowplow contract. A medical malpractice situation, you got to do quickly. And as I said, one of the things you have to do with any medical malpractice case is we have to retain a doctor to review your entire medical file. And doctors who are about to be sued do not exactly just turn over your whole medical file real quickly to our doctor. So it's a process that can take some time even after you come in the door. And with a short statute of limitations, you don't want to wait. You want to go immediately to go see an attorney and get an answer one way or another. Because the one thing that courts have very little sympathy for and are very rigid on is people who miss statutes of limitations. That is one place where courts say, sorry, there's nothing I can do for you. It's too late.
I mean, the court system itself is generally filled, and they're not looking to take more onto the docket. And if there's a way they can kick out a case without having to even really discuss it, it's something like that. It's pretty simple.
So if you think you have a potential legal claim, you know, you can always call our office and we can help you out or point you in the right direction, 462-0300. That's our number at Gervin and Ferlazzo. I see we got about 1 minute left, so right. Thank you, James,
thank
for
you,
coming.
Scott.
It was a good show today. Thank you for our callers. We did get, what, four we got? That's good. All right, good for us. Heck with those Napa guys. They must have been sleeping this morning. We thank our callers. I mean, I'm going to just give one more shout out there. You know, folks, it's really cold out there. Folks are cold. Folks are hungry. you know, in a time of giving this time of year, you know, we have our regional food banks and some of our local rescue shelters. I implore our audience, do whatever you can to get a couple extra food items and put it in the box that's in your office or in your grocery store. You know, if, when you get that mailer in for your local rescue mission, your local homeless shelter, you know, take a look outside and think about that and make a donation. Those folks are always looking for help this time of year. So thank you for listening to the Gervin and Ferlazzo Law Show here on Talk 1300. We are going to be back in the air
after New Year's.
So, folks, have a good holiday, have a good New Year, and we'll see you again on the radio. Take care.
WGDJ, Rensselaer.